This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 18th of September 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, few doubt that the US's efforts to train a Syrian opposition force have been a tragic failure. But with the fingers of blame pointing in just about every direction, is anyone focused on a way forward? I'll ask my studio guests Jane Kinnamont and James Schneider. Plus, while much of the focus on the refugees entering Europe has been on those fleeing Syria, what about those arriving from African nations? We'll also delve into the latest coup to take place in Burkina Faso. The borders have been reopened, the president has been freed, but will the military loosen its grip? And 1 year on from Scotland's independence vote, the still very vocal yes crowd holds hope that another chance will come. For how long will they have to wait? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and James Schneider, Senior Correspondent at New African Magazine. Welcome to you both. We will begin with Syria, where a plan by the US government to train a Syrian opposition force was supposed to be the glimmering hope the country sorely needed in its battle to contain the volatile war. This week, though, the US confirmed that that force now consisted of just four, possibly five, armed fighters currently in combat. But with the fingers of blame lining up to point at the president, the White House says that Barack Obama had always been sceptical of the idea to train Syrian rebels. Yet while the US bickers over whether Obama was a spearhead of the program or a reluctant observer, Syria's situation continues to spiral and no one is rushing to suggest a next step. Jane Kinnamont, this was probably always going to fail, wasn't it?
The program really has been marginal, and the much larger effort of equipping and training the opposition has been done by countries in the region with the half-hearted blessing of the US. It's perhaps unsurprising that not many people were attracted to sign up to what was widely seen as a US mercenary army in a country where there's a great deal of suspicion of the US, and that sort of suspicion is only really getting worse. The opposition itself is becoming increasingly anti-American.
Do you think there was a way they could have done it to make it not look like, as you describe, sort of a mercenary US-backed army?
Initially, the US sought to channel its support through existing opposition groups, groups that had formed themselves, and clearly going for organic groups rather than trying to impose and create their own was a somewhat better idea. But it was always a half-hearted policy for Obama, I think. He always had grave reservations about regime change in Syria. And meanwhile, what the US was doing was being outpaced by their regional allies, who were sending in much more of the arms and tending to favour more Islamist groups. Understandably, more people have tended to flock to the groups that had more money and arms. So while you have seen an Islamization of the opposition in Syria, some of that has been very cynical. Those have been the guys that were able to get training and equipment while the US essentially dithered.
You had this idea of people growing strategic beards to...
Absolutely, to get cash. It worked for many.
James Schneider... Yeah, in these situations, it is often America that is spoken about as, well, what is America going to do about this? But as Jane's pointed out, you know, there are many other countries and organisations within the region who have been trying to arm opposition groups. None of it has obviously worked so far. But, I mean, do you have some sympathy for any of these outside groups that feel like they're maybe trying to do something?
In the most abstract sense, yes, somebody wanting to do something about obviously a terrible civil war and being involved in some way, yes, you can have sympathy with. But it's difficult to see very altruistic reasoning for pretty much anyone getting involved in this war. The US will obviously try to present that the reason why they got involved in the very marginal way that they have done is in order to bring stability in the region, blah, blah, blah. But nobody really thinks the US wants stability on the terms of the region, for the region. So I think people taking interest in Syria is, of course, is a good thing, but I don't think Qatar's arming of anybody is any more positive or altruistic than the US is.
Jane, was there any point where, you know, any group that that some people might view as relatively moderate could have been armed, which would have actually made a difference, or was this always a sort of a bit of a shot in the dark?
Probably much earlier on. I mean, this didn't start out as a civil war. It started out as an uprising that was put down very, very brutally and became a civil war. People became much more radicalised now after, you know, 4 years of really, really horrific fighting. Probably very early on there was an opportunity. But because of the shadow of the Iraq war and fears about intervention and regime change and so forth, the US went halfway. They essentially said, we will recognise the opposition. They're the legitimate representatives of the Syrian people. We will give them some money and they can use it for things like PR and comms and strategic courses in Istanbul and London. The opposition thought that they were getting regime change and belatedly woke up to the fact that that wasn't what was happening, felt betrayed and increasingly turned to regional players who were more preoccupied with the wider strategic fight against Iran and willing to back a much wider range of often quite unsavoury groups.
James, we're in a situation now where the discussion of perhaps imposing a no-fly zone in parts of Syria, or of extending the bombing campaign inside Syria, are being discussed. There's a possibility of another vote here in the UK on that issue. Do you feel that, you know, it would make any difference at all that there's any sort of sensible debate being had, particularly here in the UK, about what British forces could actually add to this?
I think we might get a sensible debate. It's expected that when Cameron comes back to Parliament in probably early November, he might put forward a debate about this. I think there's started to be, after the drone strike killing of the two British citizens and the third ISIS fighter, there's started to be, I think, the seeds of an intelligent discussion about what Britain can do from afar without getting too involved, but a bit involved. I don't think that we are doing anything much good at the moment if we were to extend the strikes. But I think, as I said, the debate will at least be, it'll be clearer now. I think with the new opposition, the debate will be clearer.
The US has been leading a coalition carrying out airstrikes on Islamic State in Syria for over a year now. Clearly, it has not been successful. And it just came out during this week that 50 different intelligence analysts in the US have filed formal complaints within their system because senior military and political leadership are distorting their findings and keep saying we are winning the battle against Islamic State when there's no clear sign that there is. It is not going to work unless it is part of a broader strategy to resolve the conflict. And the very fact that we're oscillating between a discussion of a no-fly zone to protect the opposition and bombing raids on ISIS, which the Syrian regime would welcome, shows how unholistic and unstrategic the policy discussion is.
And if we were to go back to when these airstrikes began, it was because of, you know, ISIS's sudden moves into Mosul, elsewhere in Iraq. There was the threat of of tens of thousands of people being killed on a mountain, and there was this cry that something must be done. But because that wasn't just a sort of a 1 week thing, it's now sort of escalated into 1 year on, we're still doing this.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the problem. Clearly, the Mount Sinjar, there was a very clear case for providing aerial support for the PKK to get people out for very clear, very good humanitarian reasons. But you can't generalise that exactly for the reasons Jane says. That's a specific example. And we've got an open-ended bombing campaign where we don't know how it's working. It's not working very well, apparently. And we don't have any idea of what it would look like if it were working well. So we don't have anything to measure it against.
Jane Kinnamont, you say that there is no broader strategy. Are there people you know, within either, you know, in the US administration or, you know, in Europe or within the United Nations organization even, who are at least trying to raise the idea of a broader strategy, you have a more sensible, more holistic sense of what should happen next?
There are various efforts. The UN is focusing on dialogue with all the parties, including with the regime. No political peace talks, but at least trying to map out the interests of the different players. There are efforts to bring Russia and Saudi Arabia together to try to agree some common ground. Part of the problem is that you have so many different actors involved that there need to be a number of parallel tracks in any diplomatic solution. But ultimately, Western countries are still conflicted over whether they really want Assad to go, whereas Assad's backers have been at least consistent in their policy throughout.
And that, you know, is one of the main sticking points, isn't it, James Schneider, is that this campaign from the very start has really been personalised. It's all been about, you know, whether Assad stays or goes in this very sort of simplistic way that we often like to describe a conflict. You know, he has become the totem, and that then makes it very hard to have any sort of negotiations or peace talks.
Yeah, and it leads to a terrible short-termism. I mean, this war has been fought with pretty short horizons. Will Assad get out this year? Will we get, you know, past Geneva II? What will happen then? When the effects of this war, even if it were to come to some mediated settlement or some violent settlement within the next year, would be going on for many years. And the social forces that make up the Assad regime, the apparatus of the state and all of that, is going to exist long after Assad, if he exits stage left, will be there. And I think that that sort of thinking prevents us from being able to engage in longer dialogue where we think of the peace is part of the struggle as well. There's going to be contending social forces and contending religious forces and other forces that are within Syrian society. But there could be ways that those are not fought out by the barrel of the gun.
And just finally, Jane, on this point, since the Iran nuclear deal, do you get a sense that Iran wants to play more of a diplomatic role within the Syria situation? And if so, is the West happy for Iran to play that role?
There has been a lot of additional diplomatic activity since the Iranian nuclear deal was agreed. At the same time, the interlocutors that the West has on the nuclear deal are mainly the foreign ministry. The Syrian issue seems to be more of a fiefdom of the Islamic Republic's Revolutionary Guards. Obviously, they had to approve the nuclear deal for it to be able to be passed. But it seems to be something that is much more tightly knit into the internal security debates inside Iran than many of the other diplomatic issues that the Western countries are now talking about with their Iranian counterparts, which of course include a lot of business ties as well.
Okay, let's leave it there. Now, it seems that barely a day goes by without Europe's refugee crisis again intensifying while the European Union stutters for a solution. More than 80,000 people have arrived in Sicily so far this year, hoping to attain refugee status. Yet, when it comes to a so-called fix to the circumstances that force people to flee their homes, much of the focus has fallen upon Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East. Yet, in Sicily, the vast majority of arrivals are from African nations. In many cases, the people there have fled deadly, horrifying conditions under the shadow of what are sometimes forgotten wars. But amid the constant noise coming from Europe's impotence when it comes to agreeing on the refugee crisis, is there perhaps room for another international proposal focused upon Africa? James Schneider, first of all, you know, people are coming from all across Africa. Give us a little bit of background as to which countries people are coming from and for what reasons.
Yeah, anything which is meant to be a solution for all of Africa is going to be incredibly, incredibly stupid. So the largest country that's from where people come is from Eritrea. And these are generally people fleeing. Eritrea is a very closed society. It's a one-party state. It doesn't have a constitution. There are extremely limited political freedoms. There is national service without end for a great number of people. There are lots of hardships there. Consequently, there's a very high acceptance rate in several countries of Europe for asylum applications. Then you've got other, generally from the Sahel or West Africa, Africans who were working in Libya under Gaddafi. And that used to be one of the routes, but people used to stay and work there who, because they've been caught up in the Libyan war, they've come across. And that's a different category, even though they come from many different countries. They should be in some ways thought of together. Then you've got a variety of they're leaving their countries for a variety of reasons, but generally for less overt political reasons, more social or economic reasons. Of course, there are lots of individual reasons. People coming from West African countries, from Senegal, from Mali, from some from Ghana, some from Nigeria. And they tend to come up through Niger, through the staging post in Agadez, which is an old trading route, and up into Libya. So you've got this very varied view. And anything that tries to bunch those all together is completely bonkers.
Jane, completely bonkers, but that's what a lot of politicians are doing, and they're describing, you know, that they're trying to say there's some difference between, they use this horrendous phrase, genuine refugees, and for the Africans, it's, well, they're economic migrants, or they're economic refugees. And yet, as James just pointed out there, it's a lot more complicated than that. And everyone from Africa seems to be being dismissed when we're talking about these solutions.
Absolutely. If you have people fleeing Boko Haram in Nigeria or the extremely repressive government in Eritrea, then there you're clearly seeing political refugees. At the same time, there must be at least a grey area between real refugees and economic migrants for people who are fleeing from famine and a total lack of employment options. They don't necessarily see themselves as having much choice. And we're going to see this grey area massively expand probably in the coming years with climate change, because we are going to see increasing drought and desertification pushing more people out of their homes in search of a basic livelihood. The world will not be able to simply dismiss them as people who are, you know, illegitimately seeking some kind of better future for their children.
And yet, James, it's interesting that while, you know, the EU is talking about having this new fund that will apparently address the root causes of illegal migration in Africa, as Jean-Claude Juncker put it.
It's amazing when you can put £3.50 in a pot and solve all the world's problems, isn't it?
Well, he's saying 1.8 billion euros, but
yeah, yes, it might as well be £3.50.
But it's, you know, they're going on these sorts of things. You know, no one is talking about, I know it's not the sexiest of topics, but no one is talking about, you know, regime change in Eritrea or what should be done about the dictatorship in Eritrea.
No, they're not. And let's make this a very separate conversation right now about Eritrea as opposed to opposed to other things, because you deal with that, there's still going to be very large structural causes
for we can't talk about everything.
Yeah, so. But for Eritrea, there are it's very difficult to see how you could do and get support for and have legitimacy from the population for an external military intervention. I don't think there would be any support for that from the Eritrean people. There are lots of attempts to try to make the regime less paranoid by improving the relationship between it and Ethiopia. There are other things that we could do. There are ways in which the UN, for example, through the UN panel of experts on Eritrea and Somalia, does feed into regime paranoia and does discriminate against the country in regional policy, although its internal policies are horrific. It is hard done by relative to other countries in the region. And those things can be slightly undone. But like with all of these things, social change happens not overnight. And, you know, we have to do ways to limit the harms and try to build up forces that will be able to themselves change the country. We can't just stop Eritreans leaving the country because we can stop the dictatorship overnight. We don't have that power.
We'll leave it there just for now. James Schneider and Jane Kinnamont, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. When we're back, we'll be discussing Scottish independence and whether it will perhaps one day come.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
A And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, James Schneider and Jane Kinnamont. Now, as if West Africa needed another reason to feel unsteady, a coup this week pushed yet another shaky political situation to the forefront of the international headlines. The government of Burkina Faso was effectively dissolved on Wednesday after a presidential guard seized control and placed the president and prime minister under arrest. The military junta apparently set the president free earlier today, but not after at least three people were killed during violent protests. James Schneider, you know, let's put this in a bit of context. You know, Burkina Faso had the same president for 27 years and then last year managed to get rid of him through, at least at first, huge street protests.
A revolution, yeah. Mm. And like in almost every revolution that's happened, there's massive street power and then parts of the regime cracks and it moves against the other part and then the people contend with the old section of the old regime. So that's what happened in October last year. For some time, there was twin power between the transitional arrangements and the street. As tends to happen over time, the transitional arrangements overtake the street. There was this dispute between essentially the military proper, the normal military, and civil society and all of those forces, and the presidential guard, which was very, very firmly linked to the dictator Blaise Compaoré. And they were due to be disbanded after the elections that were going to take place just next month. And all of Compaoré's closest associates were obviously quite legitimately not allowed to run in the elections next year. So what we've seen is the presidential guard stop itself from being dissolved by having this coup. Compaoré's chief of staff, head of military intelligence, has taken over. He was quite likely to be put on trial at some point afterwards. Also, there was the investigation into Compaoré's predecessor's assassination, Thomas Sankara, who was a revolutionary leader in the 80s, who Compaoré bumped off pretty much. And that would have come out. So there were several people very high up within the Compaoré presidential guard crew who would have had a lot of problems if next month had taken place smoothly.
And Jane Kinnamont, you know, this is something that we've seen very recently, you know, in the Middle East and also throughout history, that after a revolution, there is at least the attempt of a counter-revolution.
Absolutely. And a lot of what we're seeing in all of the Arab transition countries, in Yemen, Libya, you know, even arguably in Iraq with Baathists taking part in ISIS, there's often this dimension where parts of the old regime are fighting back. And if it goes on for a long time, some people might start to think that they would prefer to go back to the status quo ante. The other worry that comes up when you look at some of the recent examples in the Arab world, especially Libya and Yemen, is that that the regimes have been so rigid that cracking the regime has also broken the state. I don't know if that's a risk in Burkina Faso.
I think the state was sufficiently weak already for that sort of Libya-style situation to not happen. I think there's one possibly hopeful note in this, if you say compare this to the Egyptian revolution and then the Egyptian summer of the Sisi coup and so on. There, the military, it was the military as a whole, a very respected national institution that was able to build on and then get more people into the street in a genuine mass movement that was opposed to the government. You've had none of that in Burkina Faso. The presidential guard doesn't control over all of the country. They've got very little support in the population. They do not control all of the army. So it is still possible that this could be reversed. But unfortunately, the response by the regional powers, by the West African states, has been extremely disappointing. The president of Senegal and Benin have turned up, and they've been quite friendly with the new coup leader, Wedine Diarra, which is stands in quite stark contrast to what happened in Mali with their coup in 2012, when the regional central bank cut off the funds, and the new coup regime was isolated immediately.
Okay. Now, finally, a year ago today, Scotland went to the polls to vote on whether it would become an independent nation. And right up until polling day, it was a little bit unclear as to whether they would go their own way or stay as part of the United Kingdom. In the end, the result was relatively decisive, 55 points to 45. But Jane Kinnamont, a year on, despite the fact that Alex Salmond, the then First Minister, described it as a once-in-a-generation vote, it seems like we might have another one sometime soon.
Well, you've seen this amazing phenomenon where the SNP under their new leader have become incredibly effective at mobilising politically after the defeat in the IndyRef. You've seen them engage a new generation of young people, the reaching out to the people that are normally disengaged and disaffected and finding quite a large constituency there. So it's been a success for them. The other big structural issue that might affect the chances of Scottish independence is, of course, Europe. Scotland is very pro-European. And if the UK were to vote to leave the EU, then that could well trigger very serious calls for a new independence referendum. Currently, the SNP policy is to say that Britain should only be able to leave the EU if each of the constituent nations of the United Kingdom votes by a majority to do so.
James Schneider, it was an astonishing political movement, even if it was one that ultimately lost. What do you think the challenge is for that movement now? Do you think there is a danger that they try and push a little bit too far before actually they've brought the rest of the country along with them?
Well, I don't think it did lose because...
It did. 55-45.
Well, I mean, it depends what you think the movement was. If you think the movement's only aim was in order to achieve some form of greater autonomy, which is called more independence, then yes, at that particular juncture, it failed. But one of the real things we noticed with the mass mobilisation of politics in Scotland in the run-up to the independence referendum and then the enormous turnouts and huge swings to the SNP in May and still the high level of community engagement and community politics is a lot of this was the transplanting of a social question onto a national question. So many issues, particularly around austerity, particularly around class, were subsumed within this the question of independence. And that movement has not stopped. And in some ways, it's part of possibly broader trends elsewhere in Europe. But it's infected parts of the British Labour Party, and it's still ongoing.
At what point do you think some people in Scotland might start to look at the SNP and think, you know what, you've been in power in Holyrood for 8 years. Our education system is a bit of a mess. Our health system isn't actually as good as, arguably, as the system in England. We'd like you to do some governing and change things here rather than forever pining for more powers.
There are some positive differences also between the education and the healthcare systems. And I should say here, I'm not personally a Scottish nationalist, but looking at what they have been able to do in Holyrood, for example, they have not got university tuition fees for Scottish students going to Scottish universities, which is something that really resonates with
young people. And
yet,
strangely, they have far less working class students in Scotland than in England.
I don't know the explanation for it. Because education has been a kind of massive working class aspiration in Scotland for many, many years. I guess one of the good things that the SNP gets out of the current devolution is that they could always end up blaming Westminster, saying, well, of course, if we controlled it, it would all be totally different. But the other positive example that they would point to would be the free personal care for the elderly, which is one of the things that the Scottish Executive has been able to fund in Scotland, which doesn't exist in England. So there are a few things that have become kind of symbols of the more socialist society that the SNP would like to have if they were independent, but probably wouldn't be able to finance.
And then just briefly, James Schneider, for those within the rest of the United Kingdom who see themselves on the centre-left and would want Scotland to stay within the United Kingdom, what efforts do you think they can make to try and appeal to those Scottish voters who don't just want independence, but they want a different type of politics?
Build a better society, a fairer economy, a more democratic society within all of Britain. And then a lot of that transplanted social question that went on to the national question, it disappears. There are a huge number of people I know who were pro-independence, who if Britain were more like the kind of anti-austerity politics, kind of community politics they're seeing in Scotland, wouldn't want to split apart.
There we are. Very simple. James Schneider, Jane Kinnamont, thank you both very much indeed. That was Midori House. The producer was Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, there'll be music. And then it's Marcus Hippie with The Menu. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House back at the same time on Monday. In fact, it's a very special show coming live from Somerset House. Robert Bound will be your guest for that. Have a great weekend. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.